Welcome to the We Have a Meeting podcast, where we sit down with the world's smartest thinkers to give you the actionable tools, insights, and strategies that could make your life more impactful and productive. This week, we have a meeting with...
Hey, I'm Elise Hugh, host of the podcast TED Talks Daily. For more than 20 years, Paylocity has been leading the way with cutting-edge work solutions like on-demand payment, which offers employees access to wages prior to payday, flexible time tracking features, which enable staff to clock in and out through their mobile device, and numerous other cutting-edge solutions that simplify collaboration across HR, finance, and IT. Learn more about how Paylocity can help streamline work and enhance business outcomes for your organization at paylocity.com/simplified.
I can't tell you how often I hear, oh, I'm a little OCD. I like things neat. That's not OCD. I'm Howie Mandel, and I know this because I have OCD. Actual OCD causes relentless, unwanted thoughts. What if I did something terrible and forgot? What if I'm a bad person? Why am I thinking this terrible thing? It makes you question absolutely everything, and you'll do anything to feel better. OCD is debilitating, but it's also highly treatable with the right kind of therapy. Regular talk therapy doesn't cut it. OCD needs specialized therapy. That's why I want to tell you about NoCD. NoCD is the world's largest virtual therapy provider for OCD. Their licensed therapists provide specialized therapy virtually, and it's covered by insurance for over 155 million Americans. If you think you might be struggling with OCD, visit NoCD.com to schedule a free 15-minute call and learn more. That's NoCD.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. I don't know if you knew this, but anyone can get the same premium wireless for $15 a month plan that I've been enjoying. It's not just for celebrities. So do like I did and have one of your assistant's assistants switch you to Mint Mobile today. I'm told it's super easy to do at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3-month plan equivalent to $15 per month required. Intro rate first 3 months only. Then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See full terms at mintmobile.com.
So today we are joined by best-selling author, podcast host, and technology leader. This man is the ex-VP of Twitter and one of the most respected thought leaders when it comes to workplace culture and the future of workplaces. We are going to pick this innovator's brains today and discuss all things workplace is Mr. Bruce Daisley. Bruce, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
No worries. It's a real honour to have you here today. We're really good to have you here. The first question I'm going to hit you with, Bruce, is my dad enjoys a pint, right? So he'd enjoy a pint and he'll be in a pub and he might be 7 or 8 pints deep and he likes to talk to strangers at the bar. So what I want you to imagine is my dad stumbles over to you, he's 8 pints in, he says, "Hello, mate, what do you do for a living?" And you've got to try and explain what you do to this very drunk man.
Yeah, I mean, generally, when I'm presented with that question, and whether I'm presented that with that question when I used to do my old job at Twitter, or whether I'm presented with it now, I generally don't answer because people aren't that interested, really. What they're looking for is a reason to connect with you. So they're looking for some degree of commonality. They're looking for some degree of connection. And probably our job isn't necessarily the place that we should necessarily look to find that. You know, our job's become our identity far more than probably is healthy. So almost certainly, you know, when I used to work at Twitter, I used to say to people, "Oh, I work at an internet company, you know, it's boring." And, you know, try and distract them there. But you can normally find connection far more. Look, if I was being candid to your question now, what I do now is I used to work in tech companies for a long time. Now I spend my time sort of advising companies and helping companies work out contemporary ways of working, work out how to make sense of hybrid working, or if they've got a new structure and it doesn't quite feel the same, sort of trying to help them engineer a way to make it feel more connected. So that's broadly what I do now. But shout out to your dad. all your dad's looking for is a good conversation with someone. And I'm not sure anchoring that around our workplace identity is always healthy.
Okay. And where would you take it then? If he said, well, just give me, he's had 12 pints now. He said, just give me a straight answer. What do you do? If you had to sum it up in a few words, could you do that, Bruce?
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, I'm a workplace culture consultant is broadly what I'd say. I'm not sure your dad in that state would be looking for that as an answer.
Probably not, Bruce. Good point.
I'm a lorry driver.
Yeah, he'll love it. He'll buy you a pint what you're drinking.
Yeah. So, Bruce, you're a man who is a big believer in thinking outside the box. We like to think we are as well. But I recently saw that when you were younger, you sent a cartoon CV out to something like 50 potential employers. Can you talk us through the hows and whys that you did that?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's very easy to end up blaming the system for things that go wrong. But, you know, vocational preparing you for a world of work isn't necessarily one of the best things that the education system does. And I found myself, I was at university. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I applied for loads of jobs in lawyers' firms. People told me, I was at York University, loads of lawyers' firms come round and interview people. So I applied for jobs there, didn't get anywhere there. And I thought, well, okay, ask yourself the question, what do you want to do? And my sort of lifelong passion is pop music, sort of, you know, very contemporary, energized, 124 BPM pop music. and so I thought, okay, well, I'd love to work in a record company. And so I drew this 4-page cartoon CV of my life, very much with the intention thinking, if I can get one person's interest and maybe get a bit of work experience, maybe I can get a job in a record company. And so what I found was, you know, I sent it to a lot of record companies, went through a guide to the record industry, went through loads of record companies, sent it to them. And while I ended up getting work experience at a couple of them, I never got a job anywhere. But I thought, actually, I was getting such a good response from it. I used it and it became my main means of trying to get a proper job. And I got a proper job. I got a job in radio through using that CV, yeah.
Wow. And have you, when you were on the other side, when you were on the hiring side, did anyone come to you with something that reminded you of that, you know, with that same level of creativity?
There's a guy whose CV is still on YouTube. When I was running YouTube, there's a guy who's, you'll find his CV by typing CVIV. And I think he'd be the first to say, this is probably a decade ago now, but he'd be the first to say that, you know, it was an experimental format. YouTube clips are far more polished now. When I was at Twitter, someone created, two candidates created videos that sat as part of tweets. I love it. Anyone who does something that they've just got this intention to capture your interest and to turn themselves into sort of three-dimensional, emotive individuals. Look, it's brilliant. I love those things. I'm all the time. You know, the guy who sent me the CVIV, the CV in video, I met him, had a cup of tea with him. I love it. I love people who do that, who turn themselves from being one piece of paper in a stack or one email in your inbox into something that's three-dimensional. I love it. I'm always inspired by it.
And what do you think it is? I love all that kind of thing as well, Bruce. And we're hiring on a regular basis now, and we get the standard CV, or the recruit will put someone in front of you. So we're yet to experience. But I saw one the other day on LinkedIn, and someone had sent their CV attached to the company was something to do with the number 7. And it was a number 7 balloon with a CV on it, and it was in a box. And they opened it, and the balloon flew out with a CV, which is great. And I'm sure it's not every single employer, but what is it? What kind of attributes do you think that you would see in a potential employee or candidate if they were to think outside the box?
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, all you're doing is you're trying to trigger someone's emotional brain. And while we all pretend to each other that all of the decisions we make are rational, most decisions have got an emotional underpinning to them. So, you know, we seek to, often our brain seeks to make sense of the emotional instincts that we've done. And so all I wanted to do was to make people see me as, rather than just like one name in a list, they saw me as a person. And so, you know, when I sent mine out, I got phone calls from people in record companies. I got like the most random approaches, people offering to sort of create references for me. People are like, I love this man. I'll tell people you worked here for a year.
Wow.
You know, like all manner of subterfuge because they bought into me emotionally. And, you know, that is what I would say. I always say to candidates, number one, when I was running YouTube or when I was running Twitter, I received zero letters a week. Now, as we're all returning to the office to some extent now, most of us have got a postal address. And if you can send something that's going to be sitting on the boss of TikTok's desk or the boss of Snapchat's desk, then it's pretty easy that you're going to at least get a moment of their attention. And so, you know, that became my view. My view was, like, I just want to create an emotional connection with people. And it worked remarkably well. It's the reason why I ended up using that method to get my my eventual career jobs is because, you know, it worked so effectively, really.
Hi, I'm Adam Grant, host of the podcast Work Life. For over 20 years, Paylocity has been simplifying work with innovative solutions that teams love, like on-demand payment, which offers employees access to wages prior to payday, flexible time tracking features, which enable staff to clock in and out through their mobile device, and numerous other cutting-edge solutions that simplify collaboration across HR, finance, and IT. Learn more about how Paylocity can help streamline work and enhance business outcomes for your organization at paylocity.com/simplified.
Does it ever feel like you're a marketing professional just
speaking into the void?
Well, with LinkedIn ads, you can know you're reaching the right decision makers. You can even target buyers by job title, industry, company, seniority, skills. Wait, did I say job title yet? Get started today and see how you can avoid the void and reach the right buyers with LinkedIn ads. We'll even give you a $100 credit on your next campaign. Get started at linkedin.com/results. Terms and conditions apply.
Wow. I saw Zach's face light up. We do a lot of cold calling and we are all about the psychology behind it. So when we call up people, we don't introduce ourselves and say, hi, it's Bruce here calling from, you know, we how are you today? I'm going to be honest, it's a sales call and it's trying to react and kind of spark that actually something different, and we're using those pattern interrupts. So a lot of what you're saying on the kind of the employee front as well is probably a lot of the same psychology that we use when it comes to cold calling. So Bruce, I want to get into it a little bit. So I've worked in many different workplaces. So I've worked pizza on a Friday, fruit on a Monday, table tennis table. It's great. I've had them all. But if you really had to define it in a nutshell, what would you say makes a good work culture?
Yeah, I mean, I've just done something recently, actually, because I've got a book coming out. And so as part of that, to incentivize people to buy the book, I created a sort of little video course to go with it. And so it forced me, for the first time since I wrote a book on it 3 or 4 years ago, it forced me to think about this. Workplace culture is all about connection. And pretty much the whole of workplace culture is dependent on that. And what you find is that connection is a bit like fun. You can't necessarily have fun by saying, tonight I'm going to have fun. You know, you need to approach it obliquely. And so, you know, if you say, Zach and Jack are going to head out tonight, we're going to have fun. Actually, you often need a vehicle to do it, whether it's a game or an activity or it's doing something. And so connection is our objective, but often we need a route to get there. And so there's some things that are most critical. You know, you don't have good culture unless people have got a voice. They can't speak up. You don't have good culture unless there's some sort of kinship affiliation between people. You don't have good culture unless there's space. You know, you're going to struggle to create a culture that where everyone is burnt out and over capacity. And you very rarely have a good culture unless you talk about having a good culture, and I call that articulation. But, you know, culture really, at its essence, is about connection. And there's lots of things that stand in the way of us feeling connected with each other. But at its heart, you know, if you reflect back, and you might have people who maybe have going through their first job, but one of the things you'll know is that there were moments where, whether it was your group of people at school or whether it was an activity that you did outside of school, when you felt a connection with the people around you, it was elevating and enriching, really.
Hmm. Very interesting. So we were going to touch on this a little bit later, but it might be a good time to mention it then, because obviously the whole work from home debate has been something that's been going crazy. It's a huge debate going on. Our company was birthed in Zach's bedroom during the pandemic. So as we've grown and we've grown to offices, we've never had that work from home. So for companies that might have started during the pandemic or just afterwards, do you think, how easy is it to have a good workplace culture if it's just work from home?
It's hard to have anything unless you intend to have it, right? So if you're waiting for something to be an accident, then it's possibly quite difficult. If you're intent on creating a good culture, then the location of everyone doesn't necessarily have as much bearing as you might imagine. You know, there's no shortage of people who have formed really strong bonds. Look, the whole premise of the TV show Catfish is that we can form immensely strong bonds with people that we've never spent any time with. But the critical element of that is that we need to feel seen by them, we need to feel understood by them, we need to feel that we understand them. And, you know, you generally find that those things are more easily established or more robustly supported when we're around each other face to face. Now, I chatted to a professor from Harvard Business School a couple of weeks ago, and the professor has got a very strong belief that ultimately every company is going to go remote first. But even within the context of that, he says organizations are going to have to spend 25% of their time around each other. So his argument is that, you know, maybe in the old days we'd spend every day together. Now, actually, 1 week in every four, or, you know, once a quarter we might gather for a week. Those are going to be the critical ways that we sort of support and maintain those relationships. So I think there's been a reckoning, there's been an adaptation to it. But I wouldn't underestimate the importance of face-to-face time. It seems to be like a vital component to good organisational cultures.
One thing that I've been interested in as well since we started the business is how to get people to access kind of like a flow state in their work. And some of the studies that you, I'm sure you're a lot more well-versed than some of the stuff that I've read, but there was a study that was saying that flow state is a lot easier to access, almost like when there's a beehive of people, you know, they're all around each other, they're all working to a common goal within kind of touching distance of each other. So have you found anything out about accessing flow states, and is it harder when you're separate from the business?
Yeah, well, I've been really surprised by that. So it just depends on the nature of work in that situation, because flow states generally are a factor, a byproduct of people not being interrupted. So, you know, people might get into a flow state if they're working side by side with each other and there's no interruptions. It is possible. But flow states, almost by their very nature, are the opposite of interruptions. And so, you know, flow states can be incredibly satisfying. We sort of tend to see the disappearance of a sense of ego when we're in a flow state. It can be immensely satisfying. But generally, one of the biggest enemies of getting into a flow state is the fact that people in open offices are constantly beset with interruptions. So it would depend on the nature of the work that people were doing that they would get into a flow state there. You know, it's highly possible that physical labour or maybe sort of mechanised, repetitive labour would get into a flow state amongst other people. But knowledge work, I'd love to read the evidence on it.
Yeah, and what about time as well? There was something about flow state and its relationship with time. So if you're conscious of I'm watching the clock, it's almost impossible to enter that state of just being in the moment and kind of doing your job. If you're always thinking, oh, I've got another 2 hours till I go home, you tend to not be able to get there. Have you seen anything around that?
Yeah, look, I mean, you know, I think most of us have encountered flow states either when we're doing some hobby or when we're painting or when we're cooking. You know, we can find ourselves in a state where actually we're undistractable. We're just very happily getting a job done and it becomes immensely rewarding. So those things, I think, firstly, are deeply enriching for humans and very enjoyable. But the challenge for most organisations is that flow states just are very difficult to achieve when you're on constant video calls or when you're constantly interrupted with Slack pings or, you know, your team's alerts are going off all the time. You're not going to achieve flow state in those situations. So for a lot of people, these things are sort of hard concepts to identify with because they just never achieve anything like them.
It's interesting. And jumping topic slightly, so I'd seen something recently from you that was saying that, especially during the pandemic, the working day increased in terms of time because we were sent, I think it was something like 45 minutes a day more
exactly
we were
that.
Spending.
Yeah, exactly.
But then obviously recently in the last few months, it now looks like some workplaces are starting to look at, can we reduce the week down to a 4-day week as a trial? And so what are your views on how those two things kind of marry up? It seems like people are doing more work and the workday is going up, but then some people are exploring, can we do more work but cram it into a 4-day week? What are your views on that side of things?
Yeah, the ultimate idea of that is that there's a growing number of organisations who believe that the way that we're working currently is pretty much a recipe for burnout and exhaustion. And in knowledge work, that especially matters because it means that, you know, if our job is to come up with cleverer ways to do things than we did them last year, or ways to solve problems that seem more inventive or more profitable than we did last year, then if we're in a state of burnout, we're less likely to access that inventive thought. And so there's a growing sense that maybe we could access more of it if we did our jobs in 4 days rather than five. And there's a few organisations who are convinced that the route to a 4-day week is about productivity. It's about you can get more done. It's worth saying that the only way that you can do that is being pretty radical and being obsessed with scarcity with regards to time. So, you know, you're only going to get down to doing your job in four days if you say, look, we're going to be a bit more ruthless about meetings. We're going to be a bit more ruthless about the ways that we spend time at the moment. And from my perspective, not many organisations have embraced that. So not many organisations have said to themselves, how could we halve the amount of time we spend in meetings? How can we reduce the constant need to be connected to each other? I don't think many organisations have passed into that. So look, I'm very fascinated. It's always interesting to look into the evidence of a 4-day week. One of the organisations who came out and published a book on it was an Australian bank who came out and published a book on it. One of the revelations that was hidden in that book was that half of their colleagues who were told they were going down to a 4-day week, half of their colleagues didn't tell their partners they'd gone down to a 4-day week. And they would leave the house as normal on a Friday morning, sort of wave to the postman, wave to the milkman, and head off to work like nothing had happened, and then go and play golf or go out for a long boozy lunch.
Wow.
So we've got a long way to go, I think.
Wow. Have you seen any early examples of this done right?
Hi, I'm Adam Grant, host of the podcast Work Life. For over 20 years, Paylocity has been simplifying work with innovative solutions that teams love, like on-demand payment, which offers employees access to wages prior to payday, flexible time tracking features, which enable staff to clock in and out through their mobile device, and numerous other cutting-edge solutions that simplify collaboration across HR, finance, and IT. Learn more about how Paylocity can help streamline work and enhance business outcomes for your organization at paylocity.com/simplified.
What if I told you that right now, millions of people are living with a debilitating condition that's so misunderstood, many of them don't even know that they have it? That condition is obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD. I'm Dr. Patrick McGrath, the Chief Clinical Officer of NOCD. And in the 25 years I've been treating OCD, I've met so many people who were suffering from the condition in silence, unaware of just what it was. OCD can create overwhelming anxiety and fear around what you value most, make you question your identity, beliefs, and morals, and drive you to perform mentally and physically draining compulsions or rituals. Over my career, I've seen just how devastating OCD can be when it's left untreated. But help is available. That's where NOCD comes in. NOCD is the world's largest virtual therapy provider for obsessive compulsive disorder. Our licensed therapists are trained in exposure and response prevention therapy, a specialized treatment proven to be incredibly effective for OCD. So visit NOCD.com to schedule a free 15-minute call with our team. That's NOCD.com.
4-day week. I mean, the danger is at the moment, these all of the data that's published about 4 days week, 4 day weeks is broadly organisations who are trying to PR the fact that they've gone down to a 4 day week. Right. And so I'm a little bit sceptical of the integrity of the data. We've seen a couple of things that might be interesting. Spanish government workers have gone down to a 4 day week. They're doing it as a job creation scheme. Big unemployment in Spain, so they're doing it as a way to could we get 100,000 people off the unemployment numbers by turning jobs into 4 day weeks? But I think we need a bit more integrity to the data before I could resolutely say this is the plan that every business should be going towards. Quite appealing, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's hard because from a lot of we're under the idea of, obviously, as a company, it's like once the job's done, it's like that's it. We work to a target, so it's a job. So get the job done, and then you can go or whatever. But I think a big one is obviously it's really tricky because obviously we're sales. So we work in sales, so it's a lot of it is results based and things like that. So to take away a day is a day of results. But then if it's a different industries, have there been any specific sectors or industries where it's more so popular, Bruce?
Yeah, so I think broadly the intention is to think that, you know, most of us have got a far more finite mind than we might pretend at times. So, you know, the illustration I always give to that is that, you know, sometimes you might tell yourself that you're properly sort of in the hustle mode, you're working really hard, and you'll open your laptop in the evening and you'll be banging out emails. And, you know, if you're anything like me, you find yourself a couple of hours into that thinking, I've reread half of these emails about four times. I'm sort of staring there trying to think of anything original to answer. I'm pretending to work. I'm convinced. I'm trying to lie to myself that I'm working and being productive now. But actually, if you compared me at 9 a.m. this morning to what I am now at 9 p.m., there's a night and day comparison. And there's evidence that our brains are far more finite than we might imagine. So, you know, there's a book that sort of illustrated this to me. There's some wonderful science on it. But there's a book, and the quotation I'll give you was by a guy called Daniel Levitin. He said, our brains are configured to make a certain number of decisions per day. And once we reach that limit, we're unable to make any more, regardless of how important they are. And so what he's basically saying is that, you know, your brain is a bit more like the battery on your phone, is that, you know, we all might will it to back to 10%, but willing it alone won't get it back to 10%. And, you know, you need to recharge it. And once you recognise that is the reality, that, you know, you trying to write an email at 10 p.m. when you've done a day's full of work, or you trying to do something when you feel spent, is actually a bit of an illusion. You start realising, okay, well, in the same way that if I asked Usain Bolt or the next generation's Usain Bolt to train for 80 hours, 90 hours, 100 hours a week, it wouldn't make him a better sprinter. You know, actually, elite performance is a combination of rest and effort.
Wow.
Once you recognise that those things are applicable for knowledge work as well, then you realise, okay, I need to think about these things in a different way. And, you know, I need to actually think, how can I work differently? And the idea of 4 day week is broadly suggesting that we could achieve more if we focused our efforts. So, you know, if you're a cyclist or if you're a tennis player, you know, you had Friday just complete, or Wednesday or whenever it was, completely unwinding, then you might nail your sales in the other days because you actually feel like the more complete version of yourself. The only sort of corollary I'll add to it is that, you know, a lot of us feel, oh, when I went on holiday, I had so many more ideas, or, you know, actually, like, I was just away on holiday, I was just thinking of this. And it's largely because we're in a state of managed exhaustion so much of the rest of the time that we often, our brains don't function anywhere near as optimally as they should. So, you know, sort of an interesting balance. So the idea would be, and the experiment would be, okay, I'm going to put some of the team down on a 4 day week, some of the team on a 5 day week, and I want to see if the person on the 5 day week could nail the cold calls, the sales, the bookings anywhere near as effectively as the rest of the team, really.
Wow.
That's very interesting. That's brilliant. And I know that you're a big fan of, like, work hacks, but based on what you said there with we've all got, say, for example, we've got 1,000 decisions or 10,000 decisions we can make in a day. Are there any kind of are there any kind of life hacks or ways that we can streamline it? Like, does a stronger routine, like doing the same thing daily, like obviously you see there's so many successful people wearing the same outfit. They don't have choice because they're the smaller decisions that they make on a daily basis. Are there any like little life hacks or anything that you can do to eliminate making different decisions so that you might be able to have more choice or more brain power throughout the day?
I mean, look, you know, you hint at something there, you know, and these urban myths that might well be true, that, you know, Barack Obama never used to choose what he had for lunch and people used to make the routine decisions for him, so that, you know, when it came to anything of importance, he was a bit less spent. So, you know, there are legends that have built around those. I wouldn't necessarily say I would sort of try and advise anyone to operate in a different way, but just having an awareness of it. I think, you know, quite often what you find when it comes to psychology research or research about these things, that we read it, but we don't think it applies to us. So it's like, oh, okay, that's really interesting. Not me. I can carry on working as long as I want. But everyone else, unlucky guys. And, you know, we don't necessarily believe that things apply to us. And actually, once you start saying, okay, well, I've got a certain amount of attention, and the fact that I've been on 6 hours of video calls today, it's no wonder when I came to try and write that document at 5 o'clock, I couldn't think of anything imaginative, constructive, that I was trying to create something that was really expressive. I just seemed to be bereft of ideas. Well, you know, actually applying that and recognizing that that's a consequence of the way that you've been operating during the day is probably a helpful reminder, really.
I notice it in myself. I think when I've had a particularly cognitively demanding day, I've got 4 children, and when I get home, it's like they're all getting called the wrong name and I'm putting the wrong pyjamas on. The baby's got the 9-year-old's pyjamas on, and yeah, so I can feel it.
And you'll recognise it. Sometimes you come in the front door, or you come off a Zoom call or whatever, and you're like, oh my God, right, okay. They're asking you a million questions. You're like, just give me a minute. Just give me a minute. I can't make big decisions right now. You know, one of your kids will come to you and sort of present a challenge that they're faced with, and you just don't feel capable of passing of it, of dealing with it in a normal way. And that's a reflection that, you know, your brain is a bit more spent than you think.
Yeah.
Wow. And Bruce, you're a big advocate of different work hacks, from making sure you take your lunch to walking meetings. Is there anything that you think for people listening that's really important that you have to do or you must do on a daily basis to make sure that you're making the most of yourself and work?
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, there was a really interesting piece of work published by Gallup last week, which was sort of, Gallup runs a workplace survey, and they looked into the causes of burnout and you know, why people might be feeling less than their normal selves, and, you know, whether it's overwork or not being recognised. And a lot of them, actually, Gallup attributed to people's managers. And so, you know, if you're a manager of someone, just thinking of the impact you're having on the team who report to you, or if you're not a manager of someone, just thinking of how your interactions with other people are having an impact on you. It's a sort of vital understanding. You know, broadly, when you're thinking about things like taking a lunch break or getting a good night's sleep, these are just, you know, spending time with happy people. These are things that just correlate with us feeling happier in our lives, really.
Yeah, okay. And this is a massive, massive topic, but just interested in your kind of sound bites for us, really, just to use you for some consultancy. So we run a business that's got lots and lots of salespeople in it as part of it, and it's going to have more and more salespeople added to it. Within the sales world, it seems like I think the current churn rate is something like 12 months in a sales role, move on to the next sales role, start to feel that decline in motivation after another 10 months, move again for, you know, when you hit that 12-month mark. So what do you think we can do as employers to help our team feel more motivated and, I suppose, intrinsically valuable to the business?
Yeah, generally these things happen. So you witness a lot of this, a lot of research. When people believe that they're achieving something that's meaningfully enhancing where they plan to be, we feel more invested in it. So retail stores where, you know, it's not just about stack the shelves and bleep the food through the checkout. But actually people are like, oh, this is a career and I'm building my expertise, my capabilities that's going to help me earn more in the future. And normally that sort of churn and burn vision of work is normally when people have recognised that there's some degree of futility to what they're doing, that actually the skills they're acquiring now don't seem to be enhancing where they plan to get to. So, you know, it's normally about trying to enable people to feel like actually there's a meaningful contribution to the rest of my life that's taking place here.
That's interesting. So is that that's something that you should know during the interview stage then, really, isn't it? Where is someone looking to be? How will being part of this company help you achieve, you know, even if you're not here in another 5 years, how can we make sure that we've helped you on that kind of longer journey?
Yeah, that's it. I would suspect, and you know, don't know the ins and outs of it, but you know, if you could demonstrate that people who'd been there 2 years or 3 years have ended up with life outcomes or job outcomes that are exponentially better than people who've been there 6 months, then people feel like back to sort of the Dan Pink book drive, that mastery is a really important part of motivation. And if people feel like I'm getting better, I'm sort of developing mastery, it's a really important part of their self-improvement, their self-actualization, really.
That's interesting. So and actually mastery is one of those things, isn't it, that are you ever a master of something? So if you can get someone thinking in that way of, you know, and then maybe helping other people to achieve that as well. I suppose it's like the purpose being bigger than self sometimes can help with that, right?
Yeah. I mean, I'm always a bit cautious with purpose because it can be misappropriated. It can be sort of applied where I don't think it necessarily feels authentic. But, you know, if you can appeal to someone's personal identity, I think that's where it probably, or collective identity, that's probably where it has a bit more impact, I think.
Perfect.
Interesting. And I want to talk with you about the new book, Bruce. So the new book's called Fortitude. From what I've read online, it talks about obviously taking the notion of resilience apart, and it puts forward a new program for building self-confidence and tenacity. So we're big on obviously resilient, as you can imagine, in any sales environment, you've got to be resilient. Can you talk us through Fortitude?
Yeah, Fortitude is sort of the result of 2 years of research, really. And, you know, I found that at the radio station I listen to in the mornings, it seems that pretty much every other item is a discussion about how someone needs to be more resilient and this person needs to be more resilient, and if only we were more resilient. It just become this desirable attribute that, you know, we're all told to get. And what you find with it is that it's immensely hollow. So there's whole loads of training that's provided for resilience. There's, you know, people from school children to the US Army are sort of sent on resilience training. Companies are increasingly sending their workers on it. And generally, if you speak to anyone who's been on this training, they're almost united in one thing of saying it didn't really work. It didn't really have any impact on them. And we know that for a fact because researchers who have studied it and have explored the predominantly mainstream versions of resilience that are trained to you have looked at it and said the training doesn't work. It has zero impact. You know, the US Army spent $1 billion training the whole of their personnel on resilience, and independent experts said it's had zero effect. So we've got this sort of this almost fairy tale that everyone's talking about. We wished it exists. The interventions that are created to support it don't seem to work. It's like this fairy tale. It's sort of, you know, quasi-religious in its aspects of it. But what, you know, what is also undoubtedly true is that resilience evidently exists before our very eyes, and we only need to see people who have survived natural disasters, or, you know, the people of Ukraine, and we're like dazzled with their capacity to deal with things that probably would render most of us broken. So it does exist, but I think the vital attribute that's the big differentiation is that resilience is a collective strength, it's not an individual strength. And I think once you identify that, that's why people, you know, the people who were bombed in the Second World War, or the citizens of Kosovo who were subject to just a really brutal world war there around the millennium, or the people in Ukraine who have had their lives ripped apart and families ripped apart. Actually, you witness the strength that they're exhibiting is about feeling connected to the people around them. It's about sort of a shared sense of identity and a sense of personal control. And once you witness all those things, you're like, oh my God, of course, resilience is actually this collective thing. And now I understand why someone who maybe on their own, working from home, feeling isolated from the rest of the world, no wonder I wasn't feeling resilient, because I was stripped from any social connections. I was sort of severed from my tribe. And so it's, I guess the book is about how resilience is a deeply politicized term. And because businesses and maybe authorities don't necessarily want us to find resilience collectively, we're sort of sold a version of it that just doesn't really work. So the book's about that.
Interesting. So it seems like there's a common thread through a lot of your work and your study around, you know, you talk about tribal nature of human beings a lot. Do you think that being separate from the from the workplace, being separate from loved ones, is there any case for that you can still have resilient qualities when you're isolated, or is it much harder?
Yeah, absolutely. But it's all about your personal identity in those situations, you know. So, you know, that people who might be completely stripped from their connections, but like they might really strongly know who they are and what they stand for. And so the presence of that will be a emboldening force. But, you know, it's generally when we don't feel disconnected, we don't feel understood, we don't feel seen. Those things are tricky.
So where can we find the book, and where can businesses find you if they want to work with you directly?
Yeah, so look, you know, all my stuff is at the website of my podcast, eatsleepworkrepeat.com. I've got a website for the book, which is findfortitude.net. But yeah, so but you know, most of the stuff I do, it's free. So I do a free newsletter, I do a free podcast, I often chat to organisations. So, you know, like I was a workplace culture enthusiast. I was someone who sort of loved being part of a happy, vibrant culture. And so my fascination is how any of us can recreate that, really.
Perfect. That's great. Thanks for taking the time, Bruce.
Thank you so much, Bruce.
We'll put links in the bottom, and thanks so much for spending some time with us. Appreciate it.
Immensely grateful. Lovely to chat to you guys.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com, and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Wait, you're not a Hotels.com member? So you're choosing to pay full price. Did you not hear the song?
How could you not be a member and save up to 20%? That's less than 50%, but it's more than 0%. You're welcome.
See? The math is mathing. Save up to 20% on hundreds of thousands of hotels with Hotels.com.
This Father's Day at Lowe's, score free gifts for the greatest dad. Right now, get a free Blackstone 8-piece accessory kit when you buy a Blackstone 28-inch griddle. Plus, get two free select Craftsman V20 tools when you buy an RP brushless drill and impact driver combo kit. Shop these deals and more this Father's Day at Lowe's. We help, you save. Valid through 6/15 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.
Our books are now open. Friends, Romans, countrymen, if you're looking for more sales, and that might be getting more meetings in the diary, meeting more of the right types of people, or breaking into a new area or sector, we've got you covered in two key ways. Number one, we can do it for you. We can kick the doors down, get you the meetings, and do the prospecting that you hate. Or number two, we can teach you how we do it, so you can do it for yourselves, creating repeatable, predictable results. So if you're interested in either of those things, www.wehaveameeting.com and hit the contact us form. Speak to you soon.